I don't think it's worth taping for what I have to say, but there's going to be hopefully a lot of discussion.
Or is it a tape on?
Which certainly might be worth listening to.
Good.
And I was, I've often wondered about Holden on analyzing it. As a scientist, one makes observations and records the data and always looks for hard facts, hard data we call it, and then you make certain analysis. And Holden is sort of beyond analysis. One of our great spirits here is named Horty. Now, unfortunately, many of you have not met Horty. Horty spent his life in many things. He was a professional barber for many years. But he came up here after retirement, he and Mary, and we found out that he was also a philosopher, a plumber, an engineer, a bus driver, an actor, and many other things. A tremendous spirit here. And one of the more erudite things said about Holden was said by Horty when he said, if we'd understood the place, we'd have spoiled it. But this is a place of celebration. It many times, it's the Feast of Fools, which is the name of Harvey Cox's book that I've been reading and haven't yet finished. But to give you some background, for those of you who are unfamiliar with the Feast of Fools, and I don't know very much about it, we have some theologians here that can enlighten you on it. And the author is known to some of you. He's, as I recall, a professor at Harvard. And Marco, among others, have met him. In fact, Marco took him for a ride in his car. And I think invited him to Holden, and I hope that he will come. And he is one of, and his theme here, of course, is in his book is celebration, but he introduces to discuss the Feast of Fools. And this occurred many centuries ago in some parts of Europe and perhaps other places. When they held holidays for almost any reason, but and festive occasions, but the Feast of Fools was usually early in the year, and around January 1, and it was a time for even the serious and most pious of the people to put on body masks and recite outrageous ditties, and they dealt in reverie and satire. Even minor clerics would don the robes of their superiors, and fools would become kings. And it sort of sometimes got out of hand. Nothing was, however, immune to ridicule, even the most sacred things in the church. Now, this, of course, ran into hard times. It was condemned in the 1400s, 1431 to be exact, in one conference that was held. But it still survived for about a century. And you know what happened in the 1500s? We went through what is called a Reformation. And one of the things that was reformed was the Feast of Fools. And few in high places lamented the loss. It's probably good, at least now, and it was then, that to imagine that the tables can now and then be reversed, that we can imagine a wholly different kind of world where fools become kings and choir boys priests, even for a day. It is well that we engage in feast, festivity, and fantasy. And I'm going to refer now to some of his writings here. in which he summarizes this, but in the world that I grew up in, it goes something like this. We had undercut man's capacity for festivity and fantasy. We placed enormous emphasis on man as a worker. And this was in the philosophy of Luther, certainly, and Marx. We thought, we regarded very highly man as a thinker, and Aquinas and Descartes, and I don't want to knock that. And in the process, however, I think man's mind, man's capability of celebration and imagination atrophied. It became small and sometimes non-existent. This worker-thinker emphasis enforced by industrialization, ratified by philosophy, and sanctified by Christianity, helped produce the monumental achievements of Western science and industrial technology, but at considerable cost. Now, however, we can see that this cost is really high. Not only have we gotten it at the expense of millions of other people in poor nations, not only have we ruined countless rivers and lakes and poisoned our atmosphere, we have also terribly damaged the inner experience of Western man and also women. We have pressed him so hard toward useful work and rational calculation that he has all but forgotten the joy of ecstatic celebration, antic play, and free imagination. His shrunken psyche is just as much a victim of industrialization as were the bent bodies of those luckless children who were once confined to English factories from dawn to dusk. Man and women, people, are essentially festive and fanciful. To become fully human Western industrial people and his and her own non-Western brothers and sisters, insofar as they are touched by the same debilitation, must learn again to dance and to dream. And I think that's part of the secret of Holden, that you here have learned to dance and dream. And I think in my analysis, through these many years now, this is the conclusion I've reached. When I first came here, then I'd talk to people about, you know, this is a remarkable place, yet I must have, must admit, I had some real misgivings about some of the things you were doing here. My first year, and first 2 years, said first 3 years, maybe. And I'd talk to people and say, you know, we ought to get that person up here. It'd really do them great. No, I don't know about that, you know. I don't think they'd understand. And we know some people like that, and we've seen them here. And they've gone down the hill very angry at what was going on here. Because they were raised as I was, that these things are obscene, some of the things that go on in celebration. Last night, Arnie talked about a lot of important things, but he said that Christmas was a lot of things, but the thing that he thought of, and the point that he made to me, at least it made such great and really hit home, was the idea of children. I think hell would be Christmas without children, as one definition. And last night, during the reading from Dickens that Paul read so well, I was up in Cindy's Corner. I often go to Cindy's Corner. I always go to Cindy's Corner every time I come to Holden, because I knew Cindy. And Cindy checked out at 11. She died very tragically.
Ginny.
And Ginny was the personification of joy. And Holden meant so very much to her. And a lot of things we talked about here meant a very great deal to her. And so I go up there and think. And last night I was sitting about there thinking about today and what I was going to do, and also listening to Dickens, listening to Paul. And two little children came in. One of them is of special interest to me, and she's one of the great spirits of Holden. She looks a little different than most of you. And she and her little brother came in, and she greeted me happily as always. And she asked me if I wouldn't, she was going to get the dolls that are on that rack up there. She got them all. She had certain ones she wanted. And so I retrieved them for her because she couldn't quite reach them standing on a chair. And she does things that very with finesse and very delicately. As you watched her last night leading the, when the saints come marching home. Even if she fought, she'd do it with finesse, I think. But among the things that I took off the shelf was a rag doll that has a face like a cloud. And Mark wanted the little black doll. And then Sherry went over and got a whole bag full of rags. And one of them, the first thing she picked up was a piece of burlap. And she wrapped it around like a skirt and tied it with a string around. And then she picked out sort of a ragged piece of cloth, green, and a shawl. And then she got a white piece of cloth. And she wrapped up the raggedy Ann with a face like a clown and walked around. Now, as a scientist, I spoiled it, you see. I asked a question that I should never have asked. And I'm very sorry that I did. But I watched it for quite a while and enjoyed it. And I asked her if she was Mary, when probably, I mean, that should have been left unanswered. But this is why we enjoy children, and that's why fantasy is so important in all of this. And I'm going to turn again now for some explanations in this, and you can interrupt at any time, but I'm going to leave some time for discussion here. After I develop this thing, I'm going to come back to the cloud. But he said that, this is now Cox, he said mankind has paid a frightful price for the present society. Part of the price is exacted daily from the poor nations of the world whose field and forest garnish our tables while we push their people further into poverty. Part is paid by the plundered poor who dwell within the gates of the rich nations without sharing in the plenty. But part of the price has been paid by the affluent Western man himself, a point I've just made a little while ago. While gaining the whole world, he has been losing his own soul. He has purchased prosperity at the cost of a staggering impoverishment of the vital elements of his life. These elements are festivity, the capacity for genuine revelry and joyous celebration, and fantasy, the faculty for proper envisioning radically alternative life situations. Festivity and fantasy are not only worthwhile in themselves, they are absolutely vital to human life. They enable man to relate himself to the past and the future in ways that seem impossible for animals. And now you come into an area that I know something about. I've observed animals, and they me, for almost my entire life. And I had watched them at play as I watched the Black Cat this morning. It really wanted to play, and I'm sorry I didn't have time to play with it because I was thinking about this. So I didn't have time to celebrate. Even the cat was ready, is he? But I would be celebrating, the cat would not. The cat would be playing, and there is a difference. Because we are peculiar in that we can incorporate things that happened a long time ago and also look into the future. The porpoises that I know, like Tuffy and Buzz Buzz, down at Point Magoo, and the chimpanzees who I know, my closer friends though in the non-human primates, are some gibbons who I've told you about, who are remarkable creatures, non-human primates, that you keep wondering, you know, what they're thinking, what they know. I remember old Judas got out one day and he was over playing with a goat, having a great big time. And they're remarkable creatures. Or when we played the song, the call of the gibbon from down in Sumatra on Borneo, and how the female really responded to this call, like it was the Indian love call, and her mate became incensed. In fact, so very angry that he stomped and really raised Cain. But they have this great facility for play, and we've all seen this in animals. But only people celebrate. The animals do not celebrate. Festivity is a human form of play through which man really incorporates an extended area of life, including the past, into his own experience. Fantasy is also uniquely human. And in this regard, a coyote may dream about having a young lamb for breakfast. And they probably do. I know our dog sometimes dreams. I'm pretty sure Charlie does. He isn't very smart, but he responds sometimes like he is dreaming. But only people can mentally invent wholly new ways of living life as an individual in a species. If festivity enables people to enlarge their experience by reliving events of the past, fantasy is sort of a form of play that extends the frontiers of the future. And these are wonderful things. Now, it doesn't say that festivity only celebrates the past. Because here at Holden and other places, we do celebrate future events, coming events. And our mind also recreates bygone days. We dream of perhaps how things could have been. And it's fun to do this. And so these things help make us creatures who see themselves with an origin and a destiny, not just so many bubbles. But our enjoyment of festivity and our capacity for fantasy have really deteriorated in modern times, at least in my generation. But I am encouraged that we have some indication that it's sort of coming back, that we recognize the importance of it, and especially the younger generation have some appreciation for this. And so we see rebirth of it, not only here at Holden, where we frequently have feast days, Christmas in July, and often indulge in unbounded fantasy. And Mary and others, we have discussed here in our fall seminar the place of imagination, and they've been caught up by the inklings, the likes of C.S. Lewis and Tolkien and others. So we are bringing back some of the wonderful things of the Feast of Fools, in which we expose the arbitrary quality of social rank and suggest that maybe things need not be always what they are now. And as I think about it, you know, it may be more than coincidence that after the Feast of Fools declined and disappeared, almost disappeared, there was a flowering of the divine right of kings in papal infallibility and modern totalitarian states. But we do stand in great need of a renaissance. And we have, as I say, indications of this, but we're kind of stilted in it. We celebrate on New Year's Eve our feasting is also and there they go at it again. And they're celebrating all the time. But we, we do it at, we're celebrating and have a great time. When on Halloween we have a little bit of it, New Year's Eve, or at football games. You know, that's sort of the way we go now. We get waffle butts watching football players and dream about you know, how the game could have gone the other way. Like you who support the Rams, dream that maybe somebody else could have won the game instead of Dallas yesterday. Or you who support Cincinnati, probably dream how maybe they could have done it differently and beat the Dolphins yesterday instead of getting beaten. But you Minnesota Vikings, you didn't have to dream. You finally won one again. And it was a pretty big one. So this is how you celebrate. But you know, it's kind of an inane way of doing it. And I hope there's some better ways perhaps of doing it, not to knock it. But there are better ways perhaps. And our fantasies are pretty stilted. I think I said something about that. They are cautious, usually predictable, and politically impotent. And that's and it's sort of tunnel kind of vision. That's why we appreciate the freedom of the children. And that's why I'm a bit envious of our daughter Karen, who works in a children's library and as a children's librarian, working with these children. And I guess some of the happiest days of my life when I was teaching kindergarten and Sunday school, I was going through college with these little kids. And when we discuss creativity here, we realize that the unbounded creativity appears in those probably under 10 and over 60 when they don't worry about what people think and what they say, and they sort of put up with it, or sometimes even appreciate it. But I saw some of this yesterday, you know, and I felt good about it, that they felt comfortable out, Becky and Sally, riding up here. As we got within 50 miles, 40 miles, and 30 miles, they got to giggling more and more, you know. It looked like they'd had some funny juice for breakfast, but they sort of let go, and they didn't seem to bother them. And they probably wished I would have laughed more, but I was sort of enjoying them. I didn't have to. Or last night I was talking to some of you, and I won't mention any names, but they were hesitant to go out and ski this morning because, well, they didn't really know how. And then, you know, people would probably think, you know, what a stoop or what a clod. Well, that's where this importance of the clown comes in. And I'd like to talk about that now. And it's well that we recall for you
a thing that happened shortly after I got to Davis, California. I was invited to a showing of the film, The Parable. And now this is an interesting movie. It was shown at New York World's Fair in 1966, wasn't it? And I'm sure what happened in the New York World's Fair, I didn't go there, but happened that night. And it was in the Catholic Church, and there were many people there, many of them Catholics. And some sort of, you know, straight-laced type Catholics. And and the the discussion that took place, some of them were downright angry, because here is Jesus as the cloud. He's the one that gets hit with the, I think, the balls, and he falls in the water, doesn't he? And he's made a fool of them. And this goes on through the whole play. And I thought it was really remarkable. And I guess I sort of let that show. And I was suspect by many people in the audience. I'm sure I was. And others really enjoyed it too. And some people got sort of carried away. But that Jesus appears as the cloud is a very interesting concept. But it isn't a new one. It isn't new at all. And Harvey Cox, in his book, talks about Christ the Harlequin. Now, to most of you, or to many of you, you probably don't realize what this is. And as a bird watcher, I can tell you something about that. Because we have what is called the Harlequin duck. And bird watchers try to keep, I don't keep very good records on bird watching, but I try to keep records on a so-called bird list. And one of the things I really wanted to see was a Harlequin duck. Because it is a remarkable looking duck. And over a little over a year ago now, I was on the post-shot analysis of the Kanikin shot on Amchitka. This was a large underground detonation that most people didn't want to see go off. And I was one of those, but we were up to say, you know, what damage has been done by this thing. We were worried about the sea otters, these lovable creatures that float on their back, swim on their back, and have a little baby otter across the ocean. Remarkable little guys. But I added 23 birds to my bird list on Amchitka. That was a great, great time. And one of them was the Harlequin duck. Now, the bird book describes the Harlequin duck like this. It's bizarre, blue-gray, chestnut sides, odd white patches and spots, as kind of a stubby shape. And also what it doesn't say, as some other books say, this is Peterson's guide, it has red, I think, right around, is it the mouth and other places on it, but it has some unusual red on it too. You know, it's sort of fantastic. And it has a voice as a squeak, but sometimes goes gaw, 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 while the female goes eck, eck, eck. You know, and you say laugh, because it's kind of a clown, you know. It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. And if that isn't enough, its habitat are turbulent mountain streams. But in the winter, it takes to rough coastal waters. It just has to be some kind of a nut. So this is sort of the concept of the cloud. Now, in my generation, and in earlier generations, Christ was a firm judge, a great teacher, and also a great healer. Today, these traditional images have lost much of their power and much of their meaning to many people. We've gone back to the very, very early guise of Christ the Harlequin or Christ the Clown, because that's what it really means, clownish or clown. He has returned as a personification of festivity and fantasy. To the new generation, or rather, in my generation, we had almost lost both of these things. But now he's come back complete with grease paint and halo. And I recall, plays like Godspell that Card and I saw on, I suppose, on the original cast in Broadway a couple of years ago. A really remarkable thing. And this is touching modern consciousness as the old images of Christ could not. But as I said, Christ as a clown is not new. Although, it was really shocked a lot of people when it was shown at the New York World's Fair. People became outrageously angry, and it was very disturbing to many people. But we do need a clown in this age of tension and terror. We need something that's a handy butt of our fears and anxieties and our insecurities. We need something to jeer at for clumsy failures, because they perhaps during that occasion did not happen to us. The clown also shows us what an absurd clod people really are, and allows us occasionally to admit it. This clown also reveals to us our stubborn human unwillingness to be encased forever within the boundaries of physical laws and social proprieties. And it's well that it does. But as Harvey Cox has so appropriately pointed out, the clown is constantly defeated. He is constantly tricked, constantly humiliated, or at least occasionally humiliated, and almost always trumped upon. He is infinitely vulnerable. But the remarkable thing about it all, he is never finally defeated. He somehow comes through it all. Even when killed, he ends up the winner. And that's the remarkable part of it. And we too must be the clown. And I see I'm supposed to turn to a certain page here. I wrote myself a note on page 142. So we'll see what 142 brings us. And then it's time for discussion. Oh, yes. Peter said, who do you say, this was Jesus to Peter. He says, who do you say that I am? And we can no longer conscientiously spout the conventional replies. So we clothe Christ in a clown suit. And that way we express many things at once: our doubts, our disillusionments, our fascinations, our ironic hopes. But we say something else too, something more distinctly contemporary. We say that our whole relation to Christ, to any faith at all, and to the whole of existence for that matter, is one of conscious play and comic equivocation. Only by assuming a playful attitude towards our religious tradition can we possibly make any sense of it. Only by learning to laugh at hopelessness around us can we touch the hem of hope. Christ the clown signifies our playful appreciation of the past and our comic refusal to accept the specter of inevitability in the future. He is the incarnation of festivity and fantasy. And that's why, it brings out this hope that, just like when Marco finished, when Harvey Cox finished, and Marco was then a child of hope, more a child of hope than he is. He usually has great hope and eternal optimism in a way. But I think on this whole Holden situation, and I remember the early days, the anger that was manifest. No one knows that more than Carol. And part of this anger was against this whole thing of fantasy and celebration and festivity. that we really didn't have time for that when there was so much work to do. But we suddenly found out that and Carol kept telling us, and Mary and others, that if Christ has nothing to say about the other 6 days of the week, and only has something to say on Sunday, on how we live and work and play, then it is probably of little account on Sunday either. But he's a God and a Christ of every day. And we can't draw the line and say, this is something here that has nothing to do with religion, and this over here is religion or theology. That it's one and it has to be celebration. As we heard the remarkable reading this morning, you know, we see theology everywhere. In the modern novel, and tomorrow we'll see it in the first few pages of Nigger. And so this is the thing that has happened here, and the way this whole creation of this place that's so remarkable, whose secret, I think, is this thing of celebration, festivity, and fantasy. And I just had to get it off my chest.
Our Lord, who shapes as we all, now sends us members of our family here at Bandy, who's a champion drummer. And we didn't have one right now. We moved that. There's another one up here. No.
Eric
was last year, huh? Yeah. Yeah. So with the doctor, and you played with the fish, and he's also a good coach. I was thinking on the exegesis, for example, of a word from the scripture. We've got this poor Emmanuel by this very thinking. Is you shall be judged for every idle word. Idle, you know. One reason why all the lifestyle enrichment kids learn Greek is so they know how to take a word like that apart and see what it was. It's a word that isn't working. It's just the other way around. Ayermo, a word that isn't conscious and purposive and life is earnest, life is real. You're going to be judged, you see, for letting your words be that way. It's just the other way. To be judged for every idle word. I mean, it's what Jesus says, but out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And when he says we're dancing most is when? When they speak against you from Isaac in the gospel, he says. And he says, leap for joy in that day. You know? And in prison camp, for us, this is just a common moment for us. Because we had these crazy coffee parties where we speak our Minnesota Norwegian, you know. And there'd always be a lot of laughter. It wasn't coffee, we called it 7 days. We were underwater about 20, 30 days ago. But it was called 7 days. But the prison camps got so they call it Lutheran laughter. And this is a sense of some of our that I didn't wear the one suit I had on Sunday. Dandy doctor, dear guy. I had 11 great medics, but this fellow, my closest friend, had to be a doctor who was in revolt against it. He couldn't celebrate, but he didn't want this back on his name, happy mother, and then, you know, American history, you know, mother, and even that back. But this other doctor in the same mission came to me and said, you're an offense to me, Carol. I said, why? I said, I like this. Why aren't you dressed up on Sunday? You know? I said, I'm saving that seat for you, free. And I'll celebrate. But, you know, this inability to understand the gospel, that this is the gospel. Like, you know, joining the laughter of the saints. And the kind of cosmic jokes that God's pulling all the time. Like Paul Bowie, he's the most judicious guy I know. You know, he's always careful. And he didn't want a job, he's got this pontificate. He realized, become a little pope. He'll be a lot of salary after his day, which is worrying me a little. But he's always giving me the good advice, you know, the good word. He gets put in jail and I'm out to see who should be put in. The most impetuous guy in our generation. We just start God's laughter all the time. Funny jokes all the time. You know, it's wonderful. Have eyes seen and there's all the little chuckle on his mouth. But you know how awful to get that.
You shall be judged for every idle word, you know.
Yeah.
But when it's Argon, a word that isn't being said purposely and to do you good. You know, and like some of you have been here many Christmases, and you remember the folks that got the spaniel and they came up. Out here, they wept. The first occasion, taken from 32, and he came up to his son. His son was an honest guy with a chip on his shoulder. He was a dishonest, honest guy's body, community, how they wept and wept, never had this adventure more, but it still isn't a Christian issue. I said, no, no. Well, this Bob, this folks are over there. And the voter can pray for them, make them through. You're going to shape them up, aren't you? No, I said, that's one thing we aren't going to do. We're not going to shape them up. All kids are listening, they started laughing. You know, lasting for an hour. And what it means, we aren't shaping anybody up at the building. But you know, right on the board, we've got 12 resigns from the board because we won't shake people up. What a horrible thing to do to somebody who's made in God's image. And think of what Doug is now, what a great celebrator. Wow. What if we shape them up?
Yeah, and a lot of people, when they leave here, one of the first stops, they're going down to see Doug. And now we can appreciate, maybe I risk something, you know, some of these religious jokes now. You can sometimes laugh about it. Maybe you won't laugh at this one, but it shows the kind of thing that's happening. A fellow stopped me the other day and he says, you know, they had this big marriage feast in Cana of Galilee. And they got to hitting the wine pretty hard and they ran out. And so Jesus took some water and made it into wine. It was the best stuff going. And old Joseph got to hitting a little too hard. And Mary got him on home finally. But the next morning, he really had a head. And she quietly walked around her and asked him if he something she could get him. He says, could you get me a good cold glass of water? And don't let the kid touch it. And he seemed to think I enjoyed that, and so he says, so. You know, there was a scene set, and this woman came up, and she'd been caught in the act of adultery. And there's quite a crowd gathered. And then Jesus, he wrote something in the sand, and the word got back. He said, let the one who is without sin cast the first stone. Quietness fell over the crowd, and pretty soon here comes a rock. Conks her right in the head. And Jesus looked up and spotted the source and walked through the crowd and went up, and he says, Ma, sometimes you really tick me off. So this is sort of, you know, this is what they did on the Feast of Fools. Then there was Moses. He got his people out of Egypt. There he was, had the Red Sea in front of him. Looked pretty formidable, and looked back, and all the people could see it. Dust flying. And they knew what was happening. Boy, the Egyptians were coming, and they were between a rock and a hard place. So Moses, he surveyed the situation, called the leaders together. He says, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to take this here stick and I'm going down here to the Red Sea and I'm going to sort of wave it over it. It's going to open up. We're going to go through. And when we're all through, I'm going back and I'm going to wave that wand over the stick over this sea, and it's going to close up just as the Egyptians are in there, and it's going to swallow them all. And his old public relations man came up to him and he says, Moses, Says, you pull that off and I'll give you 3 pages in the Old Testament. So much for that.
Remember Fritz Narcisse's story, though, from the hospital? Fritz is another deal booster, and he's the father of ecology in our actually the one who first began ecology in humans. And Lalmark, his brother, who was general native, but from the doctors there, a little course in his language, and Fritz told the story when Joseph hit his thumb with a nail, and he just came running and said, "What did you want, Father?" One way to stop them.
Yes.
There was a while up here when the 11th commandment was thou shalt celebrate.
Yeah, that was
stinky. And yep. I think that one of the really, really bad things that can happen when there's a lot of talk about celebration, about it. And I think that when it becomes sort of a, this is the criterion of the Christian life, you know, it's got to be celebrated. I think that you have to be the both and side of it. And that celebration comes as overflow, not as input. I felt that very strongly yesterday when Robert left, because it doesn't make any difference how much you celebrate. That's not going to bring the gospel necessarily to someone who is suffering and in need. I mean, Robert just said, "I'm no celebrator," and there still was inside him a big hole that had been burnt. And he just couldn't respond.
The one thing he did respond to was that one night of Esperanza Lafcadio.
Oh, he loved your Lafcadio story.
That's last 2 months.
It's interesting that Sherry last night, one of the things that she wanted off the shelf up there, the doll, was the lion. Yeah, the lion, which was Lafcadio. She asked me if I didn't know his name. But I was going to call on you, because this is so important. And I'm going to say something about this tomorrow. I know one of the things that disheartens me as I go into elevators, restrooms, and underground rail stations and stuff. You see a lot of four-lettered words on the wall. Sometimes the walls were nice to begin with. And we think of some of these four-letter words, but there are a lot of four-letter words and other words that can be on there that we don't think of obscene, but can be obscene. And they like love and pray and work. And this celebration that we're talking about, festivity and all, can also be obscene, you know, if you point out that.
The thing about the exegetical situation, I mean, understanding what the Word of God does and shapes us up, that always startled me in all this, though, is that the wrath of God is always described as the absence of laughter and dancing and merriment in the street. You know, book of Jeremiah, we call him the weeping prophet, but all of his images are over against that as being the blessing, you know. And then when his people, as God said, they couldn't celebrate anymore, he goes and dishes out what money he's got and buys a piece of land and everybody else gets up. That's what I bought my ship. You know, it's just when things were truest, he went and showed, no, we're not true. You know? But why don't we capture this from the tradition? And I the reason is here. The Roman and the Greek element in our tradition, again, is contrary to this Hebrew norm. They were melancholy. They were melancholy people. We think of the, we say, we go out the happy pagan. Read them a little bit and see. And Marcus Aurelius' tutor writes to him, and his thoughts you can get out of any modern library and see him. One of the finest of the emperors, as people say, a moralist, a hero of the Masons, and so on. And he writes, you know, just all of his life is earnest, life is real, dream sort of thing on morality. And his tutor wrote to him, he said, learn to laugh. He said, dulce est discipere loco, sweet to be silly on occasion. But he couldn't let go. Do what God does, he lets you go. So it's in the midst of suffering you're laughing. That's why I use prison camp.
Yeah.
My dad's last moment for me in my memory, going out 9.5 years of dying, leukemia spot by spot, and that hearty chuckle of his as he looked at me and says, and he called boys to come. Come and get me, you know, and he was chuckling, and then he looked at me and he said, okay, son, you're the man of the house. No. And then off with a chuckle into the January night, and 3 hours later, dead. No. But I always say it's like Minnesota sunsets. You don't have them in Washington, so you don't know what they're called. Or you have to live under the wrath of God and not another season in the winter. The sunsets are simply remarkable in their last moment before the black takes over. You get that deep, deep red that just pulsates with a kind of joy and celebration that's a combination of the final black of night and the final light of day, with that kind of purplish red just pulsating in the sky. You know, we've all seen it. That's kind of just the last note, okay? No? Moral?
Say, I'm glad you brought that up because it reminds me, I had something down here that I wanted to say about that. I'm trying to find it. I think of my prison camp, and it was a time when they said that. I think it was about the time they said that, they'd probably take all the prisoners and get them and shoot them. Because Hitler thought this was a pretty good idea. And but we had a big celebration. Not on account of this. We had planned for a long time. We had some great players in there. And, but the, one of the craziest things in the whole thing, they got another fellow who was about as funny looking as I was with knobby knees. And then a little cute short guy, and we did, as part of this sort of round robin kind of a, it was a takeoff from one of the Broadway things, but anyway, we did Tea for Two. We did a fan dance for Tea for Two, and I was a blonde. We had all the stuff, you know. In fact, a lot of people didn't know who I was, fortunately, but and we did this, you know, and it was absolutely hilarious. But it's this thing that Sister Carita, and some of you are great on Sister Carita. Now she's the one that came out with. I thought I had it here. She came out with, you know, he cared enough. She takes sort of a modern sayings and stuff and kind of switches them around, you know, sees the theological in them. He cared enough to send the very best, you know, that sign. And she's written some interesting stuff. The Easter message was, you know, come alive. And Sister Carita understands a profound truth about people, their capacity to hold two or more contradictory ideas or emotions at once. I think that's what Carol is talking about. This characteristic of the human heart is not a recent discovery, but has been known for years. People can laugh, worship, fear, be fascinated, curious, repulsed. They can love and hate simultaneously. But you have this, that we have this capacity. And as Carol says, you know, like Marcus Aurelius is a tutor, you know, another says, you know, it's sweet to laugh and celebrate. It's not only sweet, it's a necessity. Now, part of this is, though, of course, carried. There was a branch of Judaism that, you know, kept this sort of festivity in it, as there was in Catholicism in the Mediterranean. There was a group that did it, and certainly in our black Protestantism. And I write, I mean, they carried this through. And probably, you know, in times of great stress, it just began a necessity. Any other testimonials?
I knew of a little boy, and I was waterfront in the middle of North Dakota, of all places. And a camp that had crippled children, they had speech defects, and they had polio. And if there's anything that hurts, it's just to see kids. They get bound up in this, because you see all that's inside of you that hurts, and you see them outside with them, out in the open. We all keep our hurts inside of us, but they had their hurts outside. They had to show them in speech. They had to show them in their bodies. And one day, when we started off, there was this big Cadillac come pull up. And it came up, and we thought, kind of, oh, here comes one that's been kind of spoiled. Never were we more wrong. And this little fella was shorter than most, and he had two braces on each leg, and one arm wasn't so hot either. And the folks wanted him to have somebody that could stay with him in so far as his teaching and his instruction in the Bible. And they found somebody that would work with him. And this little guy, one day, when we were on the side of a hill, and I was working along with a little girl, and she was getting on my nerves. She was whining, as was her habit. And she had a kite that just wouldn't go right. And I was trying to be patient enough to fix the kite with her whining. And I was feeling a little sorry for myself, having to contend with her at that moment. And then the next thing that both of us began to watch was this little guy. And he was bound and determined he was going to make it up the hill to the chow hall. And he backed himself up against a tree with his crutches. And he hunched himself up, and he got both sets of braces locked in place. And it was kind of uneven ground going up there. And he worked his way along. He'd get partway up, and he'd stumble and fall. And he'd come down pretty hard. And then he'd get himself, and your temptation was for both of us, for this little girl and myself, to go over and help him. But no way did we go and help him. We realized that the best thing in the world for this little guy did. So he dragged himself back down to the tree. It took him 3 trips, but he made it. And you know, that guy really ate. And the other thing that was so joyful about that, and what you were talking about, was that we were down watching and swimming one day, and I was a lifeguard, and I had the waterfront there. And I looked at this little guy, and he was in an inner tube from a tractor, and he had his tail stuck in it, you know, and he was paddling around in the shallow area. It wasn't any higher than, a little bit above my knees, I guess. And he was having a great time in there, and all the other kids and what, and all the commotion and what, this thing turned upside down. You seen what these ducks look like when they're turned upside down with the tails sticking straight up? Well, that's what he looked like. And his head was underwater, and he was in a calamity right there, because he couldn't get turned back up, and his tail end was stuck in that thing underwater. But it wasn't an instant before the other kids and before I was in there, and I turned him upside down, and his head coming up, and he was laughing for all he was worth. Funniest thing that had ever happened to him. And you know, that camp and that experience just reminds me so much of the joy of celebration in the midst of what is inside of us, but was so outside of us as those kids could see. And I thought back to that little boy so many times.
Thank you, John. Jane, you had a good.
Yeah, a couple of things have been going through my head. One was from your announcement when you said, Holden didn't take too kindly to Executive City, and it's been quite a while since I read it. But I wondered, had a curiosity about, was it too hard or too far away and too distant, or too far removed from what most people here experience? Along with that, the thought of what if people there were that no one left upset. I'm not sure how I'm trying to tie them together in my mind right now, but or maybe in the sense of if everybody came up here and had a joyous or happy good time, and there were no upsets and nobody left angry, then it would have been a total fantasy world and very unreal.
Yeah. Well, our director has made a statement that is one of my 17 laws, and that is that truth is born in enlightened controversy. And that, I think, is certainly one of the so-called laws of Holden.